the mainstream view is still a soft landing. And a soft landing is a recession. This is worth stressing. There's a lot of talking heads on financial media now that it seemed to me are making an almost deliberately concerted effort to smear the distinction between soft landing and no landing. There's people talking about, oh, no recession, soft landing. That's incorrect. Any landing that, you know, that means the economy comes down, and the soft landing means it just doesn't do so much harm.
Lobo, how are you, man?
Glad to be on the show, Andy.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Let's start with the macro view of things here. The Fed usually does is they do a lot of doublespeak. They'll say one thing, and then they'll immediately, literally the next day, or it could even be in a couple hours, they'll say something opposite, just whatever the market's doing, it seems like at the time, they either want to prop it up or push it down. But what are your thoughts on where we're at?
First and foremost, I don't believe anything any central banker says. And I'm not just being, you know, bombastic or even critical necessarily. They see their jobs as managers of the economy, as captains of the ship of state of sorts, right? And their job is to navigate the difficult waters, bring the ship home, avoid panic. And they think that economies are driven by confidence. They think they're all giant con games. And it's, you know, hence the wage price spiral, right? It's how the consumer is feeling, how much they're spending. That's what makes the economies go. So they see their jobs, I'm quite convinced, as having nothing to do with telling the truth whatsoever, but saying whatever is necessary and correct to achieve the stated goals, or at least pretend to achieve the stated goals. So I'm not being facetious. I literally believe this to be true. And so I don't take anything they say at face value. Then again, that's not to say that everything they're saying is completely untrue. You know, the best lie, if you will, has a kernel of truth in it, or resembles the truth, or it's a spin, right? So that people don't automatically reject it. And sometimes I think they say things, if not involuntarily, perhaps a little more candidly than they intend. Where I'm going with this, sorry, I'm being long, but the Fed has told us that their jawboning is part of, is one of their policy tools. They've told us that's why they do the forward guidance. That's why there's a dot plot, is to broaden the toolkit just beyond the blunt hammer of interest rates. And so it's not a conspiracy theory to say, okay, well, they'll float the dot plot, they'll float the rate decision, and then they'll talk about it to try to push and massage the economy and the markets in the direction they want. They don't want the markets doing loosening when they're trying to tighten, or vice versa. So that's why they trot out whatever they think they have to say to smack the market down or pump it up again. But just one more thing on this. In his 60 Minutes interview, Powell said, when they were talking about the commercial real estate shoe having not dropped yet, he said they do expect that. And he said, the journalist said, oh, what do you think, there might be some more bank shutdowns? And he said, oh, it won't be 2008. But he said there will certainly, not maybe, this is striking. Powell said there will certainly be some smaller regional banks that close or get merged out of existence. That's quite a thing for the Fed to say. So this gets to your original question. And why, on the one hand, they're trying to adhere to the higher for longer as much as they can, because Powell doesn't want to be the next Arthur Burns. I think they understand that there are real inflationary pressures out there beyond the supply chains and the transitory things they blamed it on. To his credit, Powell also said, I was wrong about transitory, like categorically admitted it. So they get that. So they're trying to dance that fine line there of staying higher for longer. But they also see the weaknesses that people like me and critics will say. You know, they see the cracks in the labor market. They see the problems like this real estate, this commercial real estate issue that really hasn't been addressed yet. It hasn't been marked to market. We all know that. They know that. And so they're trying to fine tune the jawboning and the policy decisions. And I would actually say that maybe this is a candid moment from Powell when he said, well, the job isn't done yet. I think he actually knows that. He knows that there is still inflationary pig yet to go through the economic python. On the other hand, he also knows that there's cracks in the economy. So, you know, he still has his work cut out for him.
Yeah, you said a lot of stuff, and I'm glad you brought up the commercial banking sector. And I would even argue the residential banking sector. When I'm following new home sales, this is anecdotal. We had some really good friends of ours looking to upgrade their home. To upgrade, it would be way unaffordable to them because they're already locked into, you know, a less than 3% mortgage. I don't know what their exactly what their mortgage is, but it's less than 3%. And then to go into a new home around 6.5% to 7%, it just didn't make any sense to them. So it's hard for me to also see the residential real estate market or home market move at all. But that gets to the point, and to your point of job owning, it's hard for me to see the Fed pushing more, and they certainly could, but it's hard for me to see the Fed pushing more. And especially when, as you just mentioned, that they're actually admitting it, there's more pain to come. And going into, that's highly deflationary, which I guess is what they want right now. Not highly deflationary, but they want to bring the economy down. I guess this is a question of how much pain that we have and how they'll react. What say you?
Well, I mean, how far do you want to go down this rabbit hole? I don't believe any of these people have the power or control that they imagine they have. I sincerely wouldn't want the job. Powell says it's the best job in the world. The number of pathways before him that get him love and approbation for years to come from the generations ahead versus the number that get him vilified and hated for having screwed up, the odds are just not in his favor. And by the way, everybody's talking about, you know, what a great job Volcker did. Volcker was hated at the time.
Right.
And it wasn't even when he kind of succeeded that it was like years and decades later that people kind of grudgingly said, yeah, Volcker was right, or he did what had to be done. But at the time and for the immediate aftermath, you know, the amount of pain Volcker inflicted to slay the dragon. Like I said, there's a lot of directions we can go in this. Let's put aside the election year as Powell being worried about his job and that whole, you know, could call it conspiracy side of the thing. Let's just say that what they're trying to do is still very, very difficult. And if they're not entirely stupid, they have to understand that, you know, they really haven't actually, you know, saved the ship. They haven't pulled into harbor yet. Like, that's real. The dangers out there are real and they know it. I think they're tapped at, you know, on a landmine. I think they're not unaware of that. And they're trying hard to act confident. Yeah, we've got the tools. We know what to do. But they're flying, if not blind, they're flying, you know, in the fog, and they know it. And they're just hoping that it all works out.
Yeah. That has big implications on, obviously, a portfolio, especially commodities and specifically precious metals. In my view, and I'd love to hear yours, is gold's actually held up. Done, as Rick Rule said in a recent interview that I did with him, gold's done exactly what it should be doing. Some people are disappointed that it's not, you know, at 4,000, 5,000, which we still might get there. And I don't really have an opinion on that, to be candid. I just don't know. But what's interesting to me, though, I guess, is how the stocks have lagged. And you can look at that as a disappointment if you're already levered up, or you can look at it as an opportunity in the shopping. What are your opinions on that, on gold now going into a possible recession? And then what should you wait to accumulate gold stocks? Because they are stocks and they might go down significantly more in a recession.
Quickly, I don't think the gold stocks go down because we go into a recession. But let's pull back. You said possible recession. The mainstream view is still a soft landing. And a soft landing is a recession. This is worth stressing. There's a lot of talking heads on financial media now that it seemed to me are making an almost deliberately concerted effort to smear the distinction between soft landing and no landing. There's people talking about, oh, no recession, soft landing. That's incorrect. Any landing that, you know, that means the economy comes down, and the soft landing means it just doesn't do so much harm. So it's not just, you know, crazy anarchist contrarians like me who are saying that we're still looking at a recession. The mainstream view is actually still for recession. And if you look at the guidance that the companies that are getting pummeled on Wall Street, and some of them are not, we're looking at all-time highs in the S&P 500 last week. But when a company gets smacked down, it's usually not for the actual performance that quarter. It's for the guidance.
Right.
And the guidance on so many of these, and particularly bellwethers like FedEx a while ago, you know, they got really hammered for their downbeat guidance, and Intel and, you know, Apple just recently.
Yeah.
It's not about having beat, you know, adjusted earnings forecast. It's about the guidance and what, you know, what the industries that are plugged into the global economy and the U.S. economy are telling us is that that recessionary or at least weakening economic outlooks are the mainstream view. So historically, gold does really well in a recession. And if, you know, the long-standing, tired and really ridiculous trope, but it's still out there, it's still part of how mainstream views it, that gold doesn't pay interest, right? That's one reason why gold is seen as varying inversely with interest rates, because it doesn't pay anything. Like, okay, it's relatively safe perhaps, but it doesn't pay interest. And I can get a bond that pays me interest. Well, if interest rates are going to cut, that's bullish for gold. Historically, recessions are bullish for gold. Fear, uncertainty, you know, recession, even if it's a soft landing, is not a comfortable time. And that creates safe haven demand for gold. So that macro outlook, and not just me, the crazy, you know, anarchist Doug Casey disciple, you know, madman, you know, the mainstream view is for a recession, which is bullish for gold. Now, we have a unique circumstance going into that, in that nobody can really like present you with a formula showing exactly what this has done. And here's the numbers. But I think it's pretty clear to all of us observing this that the central bank gold buying on record levels, except in major Western countries, has held up the price of gold. I think that's important in two ways, because you said gold has done its job. Well, our other friend, Adrian Day, has actually said that, you know, the gold stocks in a way are more realistic. They've looked at higher rates. They've looked at the stronger dollar. They've looked at the apparent victory of Team Soft Landing and so on. And these things should have been bad for gold. So the gold stocks have been reflecting that, as well as, you know, cost overruns and inflation in the industry and operating problems. Whereas gold has remained higher than it should have. And the obvious and easy explanation for that is central bank gold buying. Like, absent that central bank gold buying at record levels, we might see the gold dollar exchange ratio right now considerably lower. And it would make sense given the higher, you know, at least as government reported, real interest rates, right?
Right.
So to the people who are complaining that gold isn't higher, it's all rigged, you know, I understand your pain, but really, gold has done extraordinarily well to be holding on plus or minus 1900, 2000 for three, going on 4 years now.
Right.
That's major. And a really important point here is that, you know, recency bias is a real thing. The last time gold spiked up to 1900, it was brief. It traded sideways for a little while and down, and then it fell off a cliff and couldn't get up for 5 years. That's the most recent experience. And the one before that was the spike in 1980 that led to an even longer nuclear winter. So not gold bugs, not hard money advocates, but mainstream investors, you know, COMEX traders and LME types, people in the mainstream, to the extent that anybody thinks about gold at all, basically all of their relevant experience says that it comes down sharply after a big rise. And that mapping, I think, is incorrect. I mean, objectively, right? You know, the spike in 2020, here we are in 2024, we're catching up on 4 years now. That's not a spike. I think that's a plateau. A technician might say that was a shoulder before the next head. I'm not a TA, but I do think we've been consolidating here, getting ready, building for the next leg up, not the next leg down. Now, sorry, I've gone on at length, but to answer the question about the gold stocks, if I'm right about this and all the stuff about the recession, all the bullish case for gold, if I'm right about that and others I'm sure you've talked to, then gold's headed higher. And the people who have been, you know, selling off the gold stocks and that alligator jaw opening in the chart of the gold stocks going down while gold is holding or even marginally going up, I think that chart snaps shut with the gold stock catching up. And I think that happens this year. And I'm personally allocating more funds to, you know, to bet on that. Now, if I'm wrong, you know, gold, it's just, it's hard for me to see many scenarios in which gold craters and really comes down strongly, especially with the central bank buying, but also with the Fed cutting rates, all these things going on. So if I'm wrong, I think the odds are that I wouldn't be disastrously wrong. And I have a hedge in my portfolio with that other yellow metal, which I guess you're probably going to ask about.
I am going to ask about, and that was actually my next question is, so let's take a step back with going into recession. What are your thoughts on energy? Because what's confusing to me, and I'll talk about uranium in a minute, but what's confusing to me, somewhat confusing, is crude being at where it at is at. And I actually spoke to Adrian Day about this, and he was, which I totally get, he's a metal analyst, a stock analyst, but we were both confused about it. He asked my opinion, and I want to get your feedback on this opinion. Either massive deflation that we have that we're just not aware of, or maybe we're suspicious of, but the markets thinks that there's massive deflation, specifically in Asia, and even more specifically in China.
That's key. There's another, you know, monkey wrench to throw in here. If only things were univariate in our universe, we could figure out that one key and make our predictions be right. Nothing ever is.
One thing, right?
Even
well, let me give you a couple more.
The bubble rates, there's
right.
Wars and geopolitical, there's the Forex, there are multiple variables here.
Sure.
On this one, I do think that the weakness in China, you know, that's a big thing. And prices are determined at the margin, right? You know, it's
right.
The last one you sell, the one that they either got to have or don't want, that makes the price go up or down.
Right. So
China in trouble, you know, that's been bearish for all commodities. And I think it actually cements, you know, if China's the factory of the world and China's in trouble, what does that say about the rest of the world? This is one reason why I'm so confident in my recessionary outlook, despite, you know, blowout jobs reports from the US and so on. And energy is part of that. Whether it should or it shouldn't, the so-called energy sector, which is actually S&P 500 subdivision jargon, it refers to a set of stocks within the S&P 500 when people talk about the energy sector as though it was one thing. Because on your Bloomberg, you know, you can look at the energy sector as though it was one thing. And that, when you have, you know, a recessionary news or negative economic news, that always gets a whack. And sure. You mentioned before, stocks are, you know, gold stocks are stocks. I think, you know, absent a crash, sorry, to that point, if there's a market crash, everything gets whacked, including gold and gold stock. But a recession doesn't necessarily have to mean a crash, especially when people expect the Powell put. So those are separate. But if the markets go down with the recession and just broader up, even without a crash, that's bad for the energy sector. So oil prices, you know, it's really quite remarkable that with a hot war in the Middle East, that oil prices are not much higher than they are. I think that you put your finger on something with the China story, and basically there's a balance here with the global recession versus the tensions in the Middle East. Though, you know, we're a couple months in and it hasn't blown up into a global conflagration. So maybe those tensions are a bit oversold. The other monkey wrench in here that I mentioned before is the Doomberg premise that natural gas liquids are oil and are increasingly coming on that marginal barrel to the marketplace. The technological investments made to recover those volatile fractions that would have been burned off before or not processed, or just, you know, the more that is being captured, you know, it's part of this flood of oil coming out from the United States. I remember it was Wall Street Journal or something like that, some headline that the United States is drowning OPEC in oil, to which many people say couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of guys, right?
But right. That's quite the contrary indicator, no?
Yeah, so I'll pick up with Adrian on this, and that I'm not an oil patch expert, I do follow it as a commodity, but I don't claim to be one of these guys with decades of experience in the oil patch. I can't evaluate Doomberg's claim. I've seen other oil experts say, no, that's nonsense for XYZ reasons. You know, all these fractions are different and the technology is coming, but it's not universal, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I can't weigh on that. But let's just say it's something to consider. And if it's there, you could see oil remain under pressure, even if, you know, the powers that be save the day and we go into a new reflationary boom. I don't know how that plays out. That makes me cautious. But whether or not that's true, we would expect oil prices to cool in the face of a recession. So I'm of the persuasion that oil is going to be needed and burned for decades to come. I'm very bullish on oil ahead, but not in front of the recession. So my view on copper or other necessary things, industrial minerals, energy minerals, basically all of them, it's very simple for me, all of them, I want to wait to be reasonably confident that the recession has done its worst. And the one exception, of course, is uranium.
Well, okay. So while we'll talk about that in a minute, but then before we talk about it, my question would be, would you nibble here on some of your favorite energy names or industrial metal names here? Because again, No.
And, okay. All right, let's put it this way, Andy. Let's say I'm wrong, and Doomberg's wrong, and China's new stimulus program fixes everything, and the U.S. Is miraculously, you know, the exception to the world. And between the two of them, China and the U.S. drag the whole world into a new era of plenty for the next cycle, okay? It's not like oil's going to go from 70 to 140 overnight. Right. I mean, it's going to carve out a bottom. It's going to start heading up. There will be plenty of data that says, you know, that skeptical Lobo Tigre guy was wrong. The economy's perfect. You know, all these stocks that were priced for perfection. Well, guess what? We have perfection. So yay, party time. Yes. Now, obviously, I don't think this is likely, very likely. But if that happens, then it's not like we will have completely missed the boat. It's the icon of the seas. It's going to take a while for that puppy to get going. Plenty of time to jump on board.
You don't have to pick a bottom.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Don't need to try to time the bottom. And you know, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But right now, my outlook is that the worst of the recession is ahead of us. Why would I buy in front of that? Why do I want to pick up pennies in front of that steamroller?
Yeah. Good. No, I think that's really good advice, even though I'm pretty leveled up on energy, some of my favorite names. Now, let's talk about uranium. So uranium has been in the news lately. Well, let's take a step back. So this was last June. I was talking to several guys in the energy space, similar to yourself, the analysts, and they just do this for a living. And really uranium's had gone nowhere but sideways, maybe a little down for several years. And they became, this was easy to dismiss because they were very bullish on uranium. They had been so for a couple of years. And then really what happened was uranium just went straight up since June. And the stocks went straight up since June. So you had 6 months of going straight up. So my question to you is, are we too late here? And then I don't know how to interpret this, but you had some stuff going on in Kazakhstan, I believe, which is a huge producer, which would impact the supply some more, but I just don't know how to read all of this. So I want your comments on that.
Okay. So several things. Yeah. I mean, the commodity went vertical and I sure got a lot of hate from uranium Uber bulls for pointing that out and saying that, you know, nothing goes vertical forever. You no price can go, you know, literally vertical for long. That's mathematically impossible. It cannot go to infinity.
Yeah.
So, you know, I in the last few weeks have been calling for some measure of correction or pullback, and lo and behold, we've been chopping sideways. Not really much of a correction, not a technical correction, certainly not 10% yet. But you know, 6% is not bad. So yeah, I mean, it was reasonable to be cautious. There are several threads that are important that I want to pull on that you brought up, but the quick answer is no, it's not too late. And one of the threads is the Kazakhstan thing. Kazakhstan is the world's largest, lowest cost producer. what happens in Kazakhstan is very important. The same way that what happens in China is important to all commodities, what happens in Kazakhstan is important for the uranium market. So I had been, people will call me a bear or a traitor to the uranium cause. I've been called all kinds of things. You know, my Darth Silver mantle has turned into Darth Uranium now, but that's a whole nother story. But hey, it didn't kink sideways, right? You know, nothing can go vertical forever. But now we have new data. Like, okay, to be perfectly fair, people who follow this more closely, like Justin Hune, Professor Quegg, some others, they were saying that Kazakhstan was in trouble and it was probably not going to be able to deliver on its guidance. And no disrespect to these folks, you know, A, they were right. But B, you know, some expert who says this is what's going to happen, you know, we've been burned by that before. And people make deductions and they seem logical, they make sense. Reality has a way of not happening when we think or exactly as we think it's going to do. It's, as the saying goes, predictions are dangerous, especially about the future. So right. What I'm saying is, you know, all these people who are angry because we dare to point out that uranium has gone into a pause here and ask the question, you know, is it safe? Well, I mean, get a grip. If you're angry about people questioning your investment thesis, you really need to think about your emotions here, because that kind of anger prompts one to make investment mistakes. It is not unreasonable to ask if a market that's gone vertical is due for a breather. It's not unreasonable to ask if it's too late. So now that we have not just expectations, not just deductions from keen observers, but we have the facts. We have the fact that Kazatomprom produced less uranium in 23 than 22, which was quite shocking. And that they have, in fact, not just guided that they might, they have now slashed their forward guidance of they were going to increase their production, and now they're just barely, basically not. These are now facts that we can factor in. And given the tightness in that market, and given that the demand, you know, there's no question on the demand side, that only keeps building, I'm actually now much more bullish on uranium for this year than I was last week or last month, because, you know, we've gone from, you know, possibilities of more supply challenges to facts of more supply challenges in what was already a tight market. Now, this is a difficult thing for me to say because, you know, we're still looking at $100 uranium, way above what we thought was the incentive price. As you say, many of at least the better stocks have gone way up as well. It's very difficult for me to tell anybody that, oh yeah, the stock's at a 52-week high or at a multi-year high. Yeah, just go ahead and buy it. Don't worry, it's going higher. There is a non-zero chance that that stock will be much cheaper in another week or two. But there's also a non-zero chance that uranium will just keep going on a rip. The setting right now is like, before it seemed most likely or the odds favored some more correction. Now with this news, with the biggest and most important supplier to the global market having changed materially and substantially, you know, the odds seem like it, you know, more like consolidation before the next leg up. So what am I saying with all this gobbledygook? If I was new, to answer your question, if I had missed uranium before and I'm asking, is it too late? No, it's not too late. There is a possibility for this to just take off. And if I had no uranium in my portfolio, I would want to buy something like this week, you know, not something that just hit an all-time high. But there are some that have responded, you know, in a big way to uranium and have corrected somewhat more than the metal itself, which is typical. And our first take from there is, would be of interest to me. Now, if I'm already long, then probably I'd be a little bit more patient. You know, the odds, I don't know what they are. There's no P's and Q's here that I can give you an equation. My sense, though, is that even with the news out of Kazakhstan, well, the last broker price index we got was down 75 cents yesterday. So even with that news, there are still some people selling.
Yeah, we got some weakness.
So, you know, yeah. Just, you know, bulls and bears can be right or wrong, but pigs get slaughtered.
Right. Yeah. It seems like I'm hearing you, and I would agree. It's, if you don't have anything, nibble and hope that it comes down. It's okay if it comes down, take the pain. It's not really pain. It's just an opportunity to average in more.
Right. You buy it for, do not buy something and say, okay, let's say my ideal allocation of this is $10,000. Don't go out and buy $10,000.
Right.
Buy, you know, $2,000-$3,000 now, see if it fluctuates in the weeks ahead, you know, double down. Then if there's a big fluctuation, you fill in your position. And if not, you still have a big chunk of that and you're ready to ride up. Yeah. And, you know, people get mad at me for saying that nobody goes broke taking profits, but, you know, I didn't coin that phrase. It's absolutely true. And the main thing is that taking profits does not mean selling entirely.
Right.
I've probably taken a lot less profits than our friend Rick Rule, who's said he's done a substantial withdrawal from the sector, recovering all of his money initially invested and enough to cover his taxes, which where he lives is a significant burden. He's not with me here in tax haven USA of Puerto Rico. So I'm still long. You know, I'm very bullish on uranium going forward. And the Kazakhstan thing makes me even more bullish than I was before on this year, which honestly, I thought the correction and consolidation could go on all year in this space because we have those people that bought cheap uranium with the intention of selling it later, right? You know, the producers or the developers that bought uranium to help finance their mine construction, you know, they're not like Sput trying to keep the pounds off the world forever. Their goal is to sell it. And if they bought it $30, $40, $50, they're looking at a double or a triple. Why wouldn't they use that to finance their mine construction now? You know, so there's questions about secondary supply. But I think now this news out of Kazakhstan basically makes me worry about that a lot less. I don't see a lot of downside here for uranium. You know, markets are volatile. They often overcorrect. If uranium drops, a lot, let's say to 80, 70, or even, you know, below 70 into the 60s again, I think that's tough. But if that happened,
man,
I would be tempted to get a second mortgage or have a, you know, sell some right. blood or, you know, whatever. I would see that as an absolute gift. I think the only thing that really takes the uranium speculation down for good is another Chernobyl type event. I don't even think a Fukushima event would do it because now uranium and nuclear energy has the green mantle. There's panic amongst the climate change warriors. They understand there is no way, at least the more rational ones, I didn't say rational, I said more rational ones. The more rational ones, I think they're getting it, that there's no way they achieve their goals without nuclear. So even a minor, even shelling of the Zaporizhia plant in Ukraine hasn't derailed the uranium train, you know. That's really quite striking. And right. by the way, if anything, that I think is really a stunning endorsement in the real world of how safe nuclear power is. You know, Europe's largest nuclear power station in the middle of a war zone that's been hit and no accidents, no peeps of radiation, no problems. I mean, that really says a lot about how safe nuclear energy really is. And anybody that looks at the track record over now, you know, 70 years of it, plus, and only Chernobyl, which arguably was really more about Soviet stupidity than nuclear energy and engineering itself.
Yeah.
You know, it's an extraordinary tracker compared to what the number of people killed by coal plants, you know, and what that does to people's lungs or other power sources. You know, I don't mean to wax too
red. Not at all. Not at all.
But I just think this is an idea whose time has come. And what I'm saying is, In a way, you know, prudence after a spike in price calls for caution right now in the immediate future. But really, absent a Chernobyl level event, I think higher prices and big wins in the right, you know, quality uranium stocks are as close to a sure thing as you get in resource speculation.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about your methodology, which I find great. I find fascinating. And I, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'll paraphrase it as I know, and this is specifically with mining stocks. If you go from pouring to commercial production, you're looking at a really good, odds are really high that you're going to get a double there, just on that. Right. And what I like what you've done is just put that out there. To everybody.
Oh, that was an accident, but okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes. Okay. But thank you. The world thanks you.
All right. Let's take a step back because you're referring to the pre-production sweet spot, and there is a free download on my report on the pre-production sweet spot. That database has been updated several times over the years. The findings remain robust. And yeah, you're looking at roughly a double on something that has much higher odds of delivering than just randomly speculating on grassroots exploration or whatever. But this is actually an example. That's not the only methodology. And the broader situation is my mentors, my teachers, Doug Casey, Rick Rule, and others told me that as a speculator, you need to understand that you're going to lose money on most of your picks. But the 10 baggers and 20 baggers and better, you know, they will make more than make up for those losses. You'll have more losses than wins, but you can only lose 100%. And there's no limit to how much you can win. So, you know, only 100%, that's pretty bad. But there actually is a downside limit, and there is almost literally no upside limit. So that's always been the logic. That's what I was taught. But I have found as an evil newsletter writer that most of my audience doesn't have the patience or the, you know, they cannot weather these losses. They cannot take these losses and still stay in the game long enough to benefit from those elusive 10 baggers and 100 baggers or whatever. So, and personally, I just hate losing money. I got to admit, it is personal with me. I hate losing money. So I have modified my method, as you say, my strategy now is to actually try to win on most of my stock picks. Not all of them. You know, nobody's perfect, but I'm actually trying to win. I will not buy it unless I think the odds are at least 51% that I'll win. I'm not swinging for the bleachers. I'm not just, you know, oh, it's worth a punt. And so, honestly, I have fewer 10 baggers than I did back in my Casey days. But I also have a lot more wins. I have a lot more wins than losses. And my average gain is still substantial. You can see this on the free track record. It's available. I have all my closed trades are published on the track record button on my website. So what I'm saying is, in order to do this, though, I can't just be buying every, you know, like Doug says, Moose Pasture Inc. play, or as Adrian says, Consolidated Ajax play. I need to find something that I think is likely to deliver. The pre-production sweet spot that you're bringing up is one of those where, you know, and the entire data set, something like 70% of all of these things have delivered some kind of positive outcome. That's really striking. And okay, out of 130 of them now, there are only a handful that are, none of them are 10 baggers. There are some in the 6, 7, 800% gain, and it's only a handful. But you know what? You know, if I can have more than 50-50 chances of doubles and triples, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, swinging for the bleachers, losing most of the time and hoping that my 10 bagger makes up for it. There's another thing that I call success in progress. And what that is, the pre-production sweet spot is that last part of the Lassonde curve from the boring engineering phase, the orphan phase, up into production. The success in progress is that first spike on discovery. And there's a common misconception out there that the discovery is that first drill hole, right? You know, you get a smoking hot drill hole, 100 meters of 5 grams per ton gold. Ooh, the stock goes through the roof, right? That's true. That does happen. But that's just the beginning of the story. You know, if the next drill hole is nothing, and I have seen drill holes like that 100 meters of 5 grams is not just made up. I've seen holes like that where they stepped out to the side and got nothing, right? And then the stock craters, of course.
Mm-hmm.
To go up that ramp in the Lassonde curve, that initial discovery phase, it's not a hole, it's a phase. And it's from that discovery hole, basically to your first resource or to having defined the discovery, the scope of the discovery. And there's a whole process there where if the discovery is real, then your next set of drill results confirms it. And maybe the one after that shows predictability. You have a geological model. It's a vein. It's a shear zone. It's a disseminated porphyry, whatever it is. And you're hitting consistently based on your model. Now you have predictability. You're hitting. That's what I call success in progress. And unfortunately, it's not as easily definable as the pre-production sweet spot. So I can't give you statistics on it. But my experience is that there's a lot of money to be made here. Yes, you miss that big, glorious spike on the discovery hole. But you also miss all the risk of all those hundreds and hundreds of companies that promise the next big discovery and never deliver. You jump on the bandwagon when it's in motion there. Okay, maybe it's only doubles, triples, and five baggers. But you know what? I'm okay with a five bagger with much less risk than swinging for the bleachers on 10 baggers all the time and getting disappointed most of the time. So there's that. There's also the emerging producer, you know, somebody that puts, say, the first of several deposits into production and they're making money and they've got growth on tap. That's appealing to me. I'll also, and mostly bet on the juniors, but if we're dealing with cyclical highs and lows, I will bet on the majors at a cyclical low. You know, I don't need to name names here, but you know who they are. The blue chips in the mining sector, when everybody hates mining and they're all, you know, looking at multi-year lows, those are almost, I don't want to say guaranteed, but the odds are exceptionally high that those things will cycle back and give you at least a double, if not a triple. I mean, some of the majors from market cyclical lows to highs will give you a five bagger or better.
Right. Yeah.
And there's a risk there as opposed to betting on Consolidated Ajax or Moose Pasture Inc. Right. It's much less.
Yeah.
So, I have, I'm basically really torqued up my criteria. I'm very, very choosy on what I'm willing to risk my own money or my clients' money who follow me on.
Got it. Well, really, my last question then is, we got it when you want to buy, though, but when are you looking to sell? Do you have a certain criteria in your methodology? It's like when you get your money back. I know Rick, I interviewed him, what was it, maybe 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, and this was about uranium. Uranium had a run, and he took a lot of money off the table to cover his initial investment plus taxes. That was his time, if you would.
Yeah.
What's your time? I mean, yeah.
Rick's formulation is when any speculation exceeds my expectations, right? That's my sell signal. Now, I may not be sell entirely. It could just be take profits. Again, to be clear, taking profits and exiting and closing a position, those are not the same thing. But, you know, that's a very reasonable criteria. You know, here's what I'm speculating on. Well, gee, I got paid and I got paid more than I expected. Well, it's time to book some wins. My other mentor, and I believe yours as well, Doug Casey, he likes to say, you know, you sell half on the first double.
Yeah.
And that way, you know, whatever happens after that, you can't get hurt. And if it goes on to become a 100 bagger, you still make a ton of money. If you sell half on the first double, you still have as much money on that bet as you did when you started with. So you make a lot of money. Now, I have to say, as much as back in my Casey days, I got all these pained emails from people who lost money when the markets went down or whatever. The most agonized emails were from people who sold too early, who took profits on the first double, and then it was a 10-bagger, and their 10-bagger turned into a 5-bagger, or their 25-bagger turned into a 12-bagger, right, or something like that. Oh, they hated that. So I've adapted Doug's. I'm not doing what Rick does. Because, you know, if something's on a tear, just the fact that it's exceeded my expectations doesn't mean it's going to stop. And if you sell half on the first double, you do guarantee it's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You turn your 10-bagger into a 5-bagger. What I do is I call the upside maximizer strategy. This is another free download on the website. There's a free reports tab on the navigation menu to the left. But the idea is basically to use something like a trailing stop loss, but not as a stop loss, but to a stop a gain from becoming a loss, right? And basically you're ratcheting up a trigger as the stock continues to run. And then when it does roll over, it's not on your first double. You know, that's when you set your upside maximizer. Then you keep following it. And then when it does roll over, now suddenly there's risk back at play. And it could be nothing to do with the company. They could be doing great, but the markets have turned soft or whatever, or the company does have a problem. Whatever the reason is, you don't want your big win to turn into a loss. So let's say that gets triggered when the stock is up 500%. And then it goes on to become a 10-bagger after correcting a bit. I haven't done the math in my head to tell you, but if I take profits on a 5-bagger instead of a double, my eventual outcome is going to be much bigger than if I take profits on the double.
Right.
For what it's worth, that's how I manage that. I'm not smart enough to know when, you know, a stock is going to peak or the markets or whatever. On this, you could call me a technical guy in that I'll let the chart tell me when to sell.
Got it. Well, Lovell, I want to thank you so much for your time. I could talk to you for hours, but I want to be very, very respectful of your time and what you've given me. So if people want to find you, and I follow you on Twitter, a lot of great stuff on Twitter, but give me your Twitter handle and your website, or yeah, tell us about you and where people can find you.
Sure. Well, first, if you happen to come to PDAC, the biggest, baddest mining conference of them all, I know Toronto in March is not the most welcoming place, but I typically have a reception of some kind for readers at those things. So maybe we can sit down for a beer and have a talk. And I'd invite the audience to let me know if they're interested in that too. But as for where you find me, it's at Due Diligence Guy on Twitter. I am also on LinkedIn. Our website is independentspeculator.com. And you know, rather than a hard sell here, I just tell people I have a free weekly digest they can sign up for. And if you do that, I promise we will not spam you with a flood of daily advertisements. You get one email per week. And from that, you can see how I think, you know, how I analyze the markets, what investment calls I'm making, and decide whether or not you want to hire me to be your due diligence guy through my publications.
Thank you so much. I just want to wish you the best. I'd love to do it again in the next quarter or so.
Thank you, Andy.